This podcast of Studio 360 is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 85,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Studio360.
Today in Studio 360, playing around with time. In her new book, the novelist Sapphire fast-forwards the story of Precious, the tragic heroine of her novel Push.
It really wasn't until I started writing stories about people like Precious and Abdul that I really found my voice.
And a movie that makes you experience the passing of time. It's a montage of clips from the whole history of motion pictures. And the running time? 1,440 minutes.
What time is it?
When you asked a minute ago, it was 5:42.
People who saw it in Los Angeles say they wouldn't want it any shorter.
Did you bring food?
Of course.
How many bathroom breaks did you take?
Did not take one.
Did you sleep?
Nope.
Christian Marclay's The Clock. That and much more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, the artist Frank Stella. He's had a long, celebrated career as one of the most talented painters of his generation, which is lucky for him because he went absolutely nowhere as a musician.
I wanted to play this piece, which was Boogie Woogie. You know, I could do the notes, but I couldn't get the rhythm. I mean, it was just impossible for me to do it. The metronome was a monster.
But to start things off...
Breaking news on News Corp. The media conglomerate is shutting down its News of the World UK tabloid.
At this hour, you know, we really don't know just how far-reaching the scandal that rocked Rupert Murdoch's media empire will be.
It's not quite Watergate yet, but the newspaper phone hacking scandal is rocking Great Britain, really, to its core. It's like some kind of epic noir crime serial, and it just keeps on getting more amazing by the day.
And in another new twist to the story, a former News of the World reporter and the scandal's first name whistleblower was found dead yesterday.
Really, you can't make this stuff up. Then again, lots of people have. I found myself thinking this week of the great BBC miniseries State of Play from a few years ago. It's a 6-episode political thriller involving a ruthless newspaper, a British politician, and a mysterious death. So we've seen this movie before, but is there anything wrong, any risks in viewing this messy, real-life scandal through the tidier prism of entertainment fiction?
Well, I think this is one of those stories, one of those rare stories where a conspiracy theory is an entirely appropriate description of what we're talking about.
Michael Jackson is a television executive who used to run TV channels for the BBC as well as Britain's private Channel 4. He says that the involvement of movie stars like Hugh Grant wearing a wire as part of the investigation means that the scandal is bound to seem like some scripted saga.
It all had a remarkable sort of soap opera, Dickensian quality, where every last piece of the establishment fitted together as if in a jigsaw puzzle. The whole Murdoch family saga, the saga of inheritance, could have been written by Dickens.
And of children thrown out and then allowed back into the family
right,
business.
And Rebecca Brooks herself used to be married to the star of a leading BBC soap opera called EastEnders.
Really? And then Rebecca Brooks being the youngish editor, former CEO of the newspaper enterprise there who was fired and arrested last week.
Right. And in fact, I last encountered Rebecca on a transatlantic flight. And the film she'd chosen to watch was Citizen Kane. And she told me...
Oh, that couldn't be better.
She told me that, in fact, it was her favorite film.
Charlie,
You got other things to think about. Your little boy. You don't want him to read about you in the papers.
There's only one person in the world to decide what I'm going to do, and that's me.
And the other thing that struck me when I was on this flight, actually, is when we all sort of tied-eyed arrived at JFK at immigration, Rebecca and her party were whisked off through the diplomatic channel, as if to say that they were, in fact, part of an actual state, you know, the state of Rupert Murdoch.
That's amazing. As we think about Citizen Kane, can Kane teach us something? Can he really illuminate who Murdoch is?
Murdoch is a fascinating creature. Everyone else in this saga, you know, David Cameron, Rebecca Brooks or whatever, they're all much less interesting than he is. He has ruled through fear. And in a way, what he lacks in this story are people opposing him, representing the public interest, who are as great.
When this guy who was found dead, perhaps mysteriously, who's a reporter at the News of the World, suddenly, you know, it looks like the act two shift in a movie. Does our having read this story, seen this movie so many times, over incline us to see sinister motives?
I think this has exposed the way that things work. You know, I think State of Play, which you referred to earlier, really does capture the feel of it.
You can't accuse an international corporation of murder without evidence.
Implying responsibility.
You paid an anonymous source for a briefcase containing instructions to the assassination of Sonia Baker.
Requiring less implication.
Anonymous source is nowhere near good enough on something this size. If you can't back it, we can't print it.
But as we look back on State of Play, where there was a sort of a good policeman helping the good journalist, and the editor was gruff and irascible, but actually a good guy too, it would, I think in some ways, if we looked at it now, seem hopelessly naive and romantic.
Really? So State of Play looked dark and realistic a couple of years ago, but now, after the last few weeks, you think it looks...
A remake is called for. I think if you want to see a pretty good depiction of what a British journalist is like, go see the Errol Morris film Tabloid.
Brand new documentary.
Which has just come out. And it depicts a bizarre sort of sex scandal story involving a Mormon missionary in Britain. A story of no particular interest.
Yeah.
But in the film, you see terrific interviews with British tabloid journalists. And you see them at their sort of terrible best. They are funny, they are cynical, they've seen the world, and they're sort of rich and happy. And then you see the people they cover, and you see sort of destroyed lives. And the sort of combination of insouciance on the one hand and destruction on the other is the great story of British tabloid journalism.
Michael Jackson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Jackson is a media executive who used to run TV channels in Britain and cable channels here in America. What is the longest movie you've ever sat through? The Kenneth Branagh Hamlet was 4 hours. The documentary Shoah was 9. Those are short subjects compared to a new film called The Clock. It is 24 hours long. The Clock is a mashup of more than 1,000 movie clips by the artist Christian Marclay. It may sound more like an endurance test than a piece of art, but it is a surprisingly popular one. 4,000 people showed up recently for one screening at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. LACMA will screen all 24 hours once more next week. And KCRW's Matt Holtzman went to see what makes the clock, you know, tick.
What time is it?
When you asked a minute ago, it was 5:42. It is now 5:43.
The Clock is made up of scenes from 100 years of TV and film, American and French, famous and obscure, classic and really bad. In almost every scene, someone looks at their watch or walks by a clock or says the time. The gimmick is that the clock is as much a timepiece as an art piece. So when you're watching a clip from The Apartment and Fred McMurray says,
"Look, Fran, I didn't realize it was so late. It's 6:45.
It's actually 6:45. Christian Markley's assistants, he had six of them, dredged every corner of their local video shop to find references to almost every minute in the day, all 1,440 of them. Not even the artist can name all the movies in the clock.
There's time enough at last.
But here's what's really amazing. You know how you usually walk out of the Cineplex going, it was a pretty good movie, but it was too long? Well, no one I talked to said anything like that about the clock. In fact, quite the opposite.
The piece is the clock, and it's 24 hours. So they only see partially, you're not seeing the whole work. It's like, you know, reading a few pages of Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Sean Hathwell is a big movie buff, and he's just plain big. He's 6'7 and 250-something pounds. Sean was one of the thousands of people who waited in line at LACMA's 24-hour screening of The Clock in May. But he stayed for the whole thing, from 11 a.m. to 11 a.m.
Did you bring food?
Of course. And make sure I wore comfortable clothes.
How many bathroom breaks did you take?
I did not take one.
Did you sleep?
Nope. I mean, there are a couple times where, yeah, you're thinking, oh, maybe I'll just catch a wink here and there. But then you would just keep getting sucked in.
People usually don't have time to do anything, right?
That's the artist Christian Markley. He's best known for scratchy, glitchy DJ music, and he has top-notch credentials as an avant-garde video artist. And yet with The Clock, he's made a film that's more engaging than a lot of mainstream movies.
And video is sort of the bad art of art. It's like the kind of thing that people just peek into a dark room. So to actually see people spend a whole afternoon, a whole day, or even a whole night in this installation is surprising.
I wanted to see The Clock for myself, so my filmmaker friend Aldo and I slipped behind the curtains and into the makeshift theater at LACMA and plopped down on one of the slip-covered sofas.
I thought it was going to be a series of clips, which wasn't so interesting to me, but somehow he's melding them together in a way that the sound from one scene goes over into the sound for the next scene.
So somebody looks across the room and then the other person who's looking back is in a whole other movie.
So he's using traditional editing techniques to cut in between totally different films, and it weirdly works. It feels like these people are communicating with each other across time and across films.
The first thing that you notice is that The Clock is amazingly well made. The second thing you notice is that everyone's sitting there trying to name the movies.
Scream?
No.
All About Eve. This is the time machine.
Some horrible Bruce Willis movie.
In each scene where you don't recognize the film, which is a lot of the time, you can't help but try to figure out what's going on.
I was asking my assistant early on to look for footage of people doing nothing. I mean, a lot of movies, you know, have those moments. But when you string them together, in a way, they become less boring, maybe, because you're trying to understand, like, why are they in that state?
Now here, Henry Fonda is walking into a liquor store.
There's some problem. Immediately, you have to wonder what it is. Oh, yeah, he's got a drinking problem because he's walking out without having bought anything.
Even though a lot of the time nothing is happening on screen, or at least you're not sure what's happening, the clock is relentlessly tense. We've all seen a lot of movies, and we're trained for things to get wrapped up neatly.
The idea of climax.
Christine Kim is a curator at LACMA.
The expectation, I mean, the penultimate scene before the big scene, and we all know the big scene, and then he switches to another scene, so then you're waiting to go back playing with your sense of expectation. And I have not met a single person who did not overstay.
I had that experience, and so did everybody I talked to. It seems that the clock isn't like your Timex. It doesn't just give you the time. It takes it away.
I lost a lot of time in that hour.
I really had to pull myself away.
It's bizarrely compelling.
I was stunned when I realized we had been sitting there for an hour.
The clock keeps you sitting there by making emotional promises, but rarely keeping them. But Sean Hathwell says when the clock does pay off, it pays off big time, like at midnight.
You're thinking, okay, all those movies with people celebrating New Year's, it's going to be Auld Lang Syne all over the place. And he doesn't. Instead, he does something really cool. And the clock strikes 12. He goes 12 shots, 12 different clocks, 12 different chimes. And as each chime went off, ding, dong, dong, you could feel the audience buzz. And by the end of the 12th one, the whole crowd erupted spontaneously in a cheer.
And that's what makes The Clock something very rare. It's avant-garde art that's also totally fun. But how it makes you think and feel about time is ultimately what makes it so much more than just entertaining. You start to notice how long or how short a minute can feel, and how obsessed we are with being on time, and just how many kinds of devices we've come up with to keep us on time. In a way, a watch captured on film tells past time. By linking our time with past time, Christian Markley has managed to create a remarkable experience. Museum trustee and Hollywood producer Steve Tisch bought the clock for LACMA.
You know, when you sit and look at that screen, your own sort of personal feelings and the journey the movie sort of encourages you to take is fascinating. I mean, you know, I felt a mix of nostalgia, but at the same time, the more I let myself be taken by what I saw on the screen, the nostalgia led to creating an awareness of my own mortality, which was a very unexpected emotion. But I couldn't fight it. I couldn't resist it.
Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio.
I don't usually watch old black and white movies and look at the actors and think, hey, they're all dead. But mix those movies up with modern color films and put a clock ticking in the background the whole time, and the clock makes you all too aware that
time goes on and never stops. We can't stop it. It never stops. Minute by minute, second by second, it's cutting off our heads.
Of course, 10 or 50 years from now, after all of us sitting in the theater at LACMA have taken a licking, it's likely that the clock will still be ticking.
This piece will be seen over many, many, many years and remain timeless.
For Studio 360, I'm Matt Holzman.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, hon. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight.
There's one more 24-hour screening of The Clock in L.A. this week at LACMA. You can get details and see some stills from the movie at studio360.org. Coming up, when Ramona Lofton was in her late 20s, she decided it was time for a new name. She chose just one word, sapphire.
It fit in with the feminist kind of gemstone type of radiance. And it had the negative connotation of, from Amos and Andy,
right,
of an aggressive and assertive black woman who was mean to people. By mean, she just stood up for herself.
The novelist Sapphire reinvents herself. That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. We'll be right back. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. When you read a novel and invest hours and hours in the lives of the characters, you naturally want to know what happens to them after the last page. That is what the writer Sapphire has done with her new novel, The Kid. It's a sequel to her book, Push, which was turned into the movie Precious. Push and Precious are the story, an absolutely harrowing story, of a Harlem teenager, poor and obese and HIV positive and pregnant by her own father. But toward the end of the story, there's a glimmer of hope when Precious gives birth to the baby.
His name, Abdul Jamal Lewis Jones. He healthy. His mother loved him.
And that baby, Abdul, is the kid, the hero of Sapphire's new novel, which picks up when he's 9 years old. I asked her to read the opening passage of the new novel.
The novel begins on the day of Precious Jones' funeral. She has died and left behind 9-year-old Abdul. He's sleeping at Rita Romero's hotel room, and she's trying to wake him up and tell him to get ready for the funeral. "Wake up, little man." Rita's voice is coming under the covers at me. It's warm under the covers, smell good like Rita and clean like sheets. I curl up tighter, squeeze my eyes shut, and go back to sleep. In the dream, it's Mommy's birthday party, and she's holding me in her arms, kissing me and dancing with me. Our house is smelling like lasagna, wine, and people, mostly girls, sweating in perfume. One girl is smoking weed. Everyone is laughing. Mommy puts me down and goes to open her presents. She's sitting in the blue armchair under the light. All the people have presents in their hands and are holding them out to her. A lady who looks nice, but when she smiles, all her teeth is black, is holding out a pretty present tied with a gold ribbon. No, 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 I want to say. But no words come out my mouth, and Mommy takes the box, and I want to stay asleep, even though I know it's a bomb and I'm not dreaming anymore. And if I was dreaming, the bomb would be exploding now, and now that it's too late, my voice would be loud. Abdul, someone is shaking my shoulder. Rita, I squeeze my eyes shut. When I open them, when I stick my head out from under the covers, my mother will be dead, and today will be her funeral.
That is the novelist Sapphire reading from her new book, The Kid. So there's, as I suggested, a 9-year gap between Push, Clarissa's story, and this new story, The Kid, about her son Abdul. What happens in the life of Precious and her son between these two stories?
We do get a little bit of Precious's life in The Kid, but only through memories that Abdul has. And we find out that she did pretty good, you know, that Miss Rain and her cohort of Each One Teach One friends, they helped her and she got her GED and she got an apartment. She became independent of her mother and she started to put her heart and soul into trying to raise this baby boy.
The glimmer of hope that we saw came out of it, not bad.
Yeah, it manifested. She did become a functional person and a pretty good mom.
Push was your first novel. This is your second. 16 years between them. Was this percolating all the time? Did you deny yourself the writing of it? What was going on?
I spent almost 10 years off and on writing it. You know, I would get going, then I would get a good teaching job, and I would take that. And I think what really made me finish it was when the movie came out and I saw the interest that people had, I said, it's now or never. You know, now is the time to move forward with this story.
That put some fire.
Yeah, that kind of like, yeah, go for it.
Ms. Rain, whom you mentioned, who was Precious's teacher and mentor, shows up briefly near the beginning of this book.
In the first part at the funeral, all the previous characters are assembled. And Miss Rain is there, and Rita Romero is there, and just various people who have had something to do with Precious in her life. But for the most part, with the exception of Rita Romero, they abandon.
Go away.
They abandon Abdul. That first chapter is kind of the tragedy of single motherhood. When this woman dies, when Precious dies, there is
nobody.
No one else. There is no extended family, and it's a tragedy.
Abdul narrates the novel, and we begin, as we heard, when he's a little boy, and he becomes almost grown. There is a horrible thread of abuse in his life, as there was in his mother's as well. From the sound of it, reading about your life, you had a pretty solid two-parent family. Mm-hmm. Where do you go to find this material?
I pretty much patterned myself after the people who I admired. I read Alice Walker. I read, Dostoevsky. I read Toni Morrison. I am the descendant of slaves, you know what I mean? And the tradition of African-American literature is to write about the dispossessed, is to write about those without voice. And it really wasn't until I started writing stories about people like Precious and Abdul that I really found my voice.
You really did write it from the beginning with that kind of social responsibility?
I think so. And I think it really shows in the first chapter, because in the first chapter is really all about adoption and social services.
Of the kid. Yeah.
Of the kid. You really do see the issues of foster care. And then in the same way with Push, the character starts to take over. And I just let him have his story. You know what I mean?
Well, and he goes from a foster home to a Catholic boys' school. He has this difficult chain of abusive outsourced care. But then with him in this book, you offer this glimmer of hope, which is when he discovers dance. How did you choose dance, or how, as he became a walking, talking character in your head, did he find dance?
I found as I was writing the text, and I inflicted so much pain on his physical body. And
through the abuse he has suffered
and how he's objectified by people. And the last time this boy was really happy was when he was connected to his mother, when his mother was alive. And I really realized that his whole connection with his body had been broken when the mother died. And I don't know of a better way and a more holistic way to reclaim that connection with the body than through dance.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted him to have joy and power in a positive way, because the way he's learning to get power from the abuse is by abusing others. And so through the dance, we see him as a young man begin to have some power just by having autonomy and control over himself.
Could you read the bit where he discovers dance?
Okay. Usually, if ain't no guys playing basketball, the gym is empty. But when we get up the stairs, I stop short. All kind of people in here today dressed in bright colored tights, leotards, and sweats. Some got on African clothes. On one side of the room, like trees growing up from the floor, are four shiny drums sitting in front of four empty chairs. A big guy, taller than me, in a long white African robe, sits down behind the biggest drum. Then three more dudes sit down behind the other drums. They go bap, bap, tee-dee-dee-dee, bap, bap. Another guy picks up a flute and starts to blow. It's so beautiful, it hurts, like someone just kicked me in the balls. Then wild, man, wild, wild. Maybe it's the black tie we were smoking. Maybe it's still real. Something stops screaming in my head. In 1 second, I know my life. It's this sound.
That is Sapphire reading from her new novel, The Kid. That is the ultimate aha moment.
Exactly, exactly. He discovers a path, and despite all the kind of pitfalls that he's going to go through, this is the one thing, this ambition to be a dancer, which really keeps him on track, and it also keeps him from being a monster. There's a couple
right.
of times when he's getting ready to do some really bad things, and he thinks, well, if I do that, I won't get to dance.
Right.
If I do that, they'll lock me up.
So there's this alternative route that
exactly.
it gives.
Exactly. Yeah. By finding this, he begins to have a choice.
Yeah.
I can go off the deep end, or I can somehow just keep struggling and find a way to become a dancer.
Did you have a moment like that? Was there a writer, a book you read, and you thought, my God, this has changed my life?
There were three big books in my life. And one of them was Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs. And this was the first book written by an African-American
right.
woman that we know of. And when I first read it, I wasn't so thrilled with it. When I understood that all the other books that we knew about had been dictated and written by white women,
right.
that black women hadn't really written them, and that Harriet Jacobs had first gone to Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, and asked her to write the book for her. And Harriet Beecher Stowe was so disrespectful that Harriet Jacobs just took her little notebooks home and said, I'm going to write my own book. I said, yo-ho!
I never knew that backstory.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
great.
That was amazing to me. The next big book in my life was Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, centered in the life of this little girl, Picola Breedlove. And again, this is a black woman writing this book, and I'm thinking, yeah, I think, you know, there's something in me that might be able to do something like that. And then I think, along with the rest of the world, The Color Purple just blew me away.
Right. You were born Ramona Lofton.
Yes.
Which is a wonderful name. I think it made me think when I discovered that you were called Ramona, it made me think of the Beverly Cleary character Ramona.
I know her well.
Yes.
I know her.
Remind me. I can imagine you as a little Ramona.
Yeah.
When and why did you take on Sapphire as your name?
I took on the name Sapphire in the 70s, and a lot of women were changing their patriarchal names.
Slave names.
Their patriarchal slave names to things like Lydia Free Woman and Opalescence Grows. And that
aren't you glad you didn't do that?
I'm so glad I didn't do that. I am so glad I didn't do that. And I took on the name Sapphire. It had two connotations. It fit in with the feminist kind of gemstone type of radiance.
And then Kingfish's wife.
And it had the
from Amos and Andy.
It had the negative connotation of from Amos and Andy
right.
of an aggressive and assertive black woman who was mean to people. And by mean, she just stood up for herself and had a big mouth. And I didn't think that was so bad, given the passivity that we were struggling against as young feminists.
Well, and it's as you say, unlike some of, you know, opalescence free woman, it doesn't seem dated and embarrassing 30 years later.
No, exactly. I don't have to change back. Yeah.
Sapphire, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sapphire's new novel, The Kid, is available now. Sapphire also told me she was reluctant for a long time to turn Precious's story into a movie. You can hear what changed her mind at Studio360.org. Last week, the New York Times architecture critic called the new CCTV headquarters in Beijing the greatest work of architecture built in this century. I wouldn't argue with that. The CCTV tower is a giant Mobius strip, this glassy, twisting arch that looks just impossible, as though it were a digital effect from one of the Star Wars cityscapes. I wandered through it a couple of years ago and was blown away. It's almost as if today's greatest architects are locked into a game of one-upsmanship. The more outrageous and unconventional, the better. But John Silber thinks this is a disaster. It results in big cost overruns and, he thinks, monuments to vanity. Silber is the former president of Boston University and the author of a book called Architecture of the Absurd, How, quote, Genius Disfigured a Practical Art. I spoke with him in 2008.
The point about architecture is that it is not a fine art. It is a practical art. It is an art that is not to be confused with painting, sculpture, or music, or any of the other fine arts. One can build a sculpture any way one wants to, and it doesn't matter. If somebody doesn't like it, they don't have to look at it. But when you build a building, you're building it for people who have to live and work in it. You're building it for a client who has a purpose for that building. And to ignore the interests of the clients and the interests of the people who live there, and moreover, to ignore the budgetary limitations of the client, it seems to me, is inexcusable. And some of our most notable iconic, so-called iconic architects like Gehry and Libeskind and Hull.
That's Daniel Libeskind, Frank Gehry, and Steve Hull.
Yeah, they behave as if they are sculptors. And Gehry is very proud of the fact that he repudiates this thing.
Now, was the Gehry building at MIT, since you lived in Boston for so many years, that sort of set you off on this diatribe?
No, it wasn't the one that set me off, but it was the one that was sort of the coup de grace.
Uh-huh.
I thought if anybody thinks that Gehry is not engaged in a con job, they haven't looked at that building. It just reminded me instantly. As soon as I saw this thing, I said, you know, old Dolly Parton had it right. It takes lots of money to look this cheap. It's appalling. I could look at it before. I'd ever seen it in the wintertime. I said, you know, this building is going to leak like a sieve. The ice and snow are going to catch on all these projections. It's going to be terrible. It's going to be dangerous. And it can't be used.
Mm-hmm.
He designed a building on the upper floors, which the faculty referred to as the vomitorium. It was designed deliberately to make it visually discomforting. He referred to the limitations that are imposed on architects, and to put it succinctly, he said, screw that.
But isn't all, I mean, our great architecture for centuries has always been a result, or often been a result, of that tension and that struggle between art and function, between whimsy and practicality, between being unfamiliar and being simply useful. Doesn't great architecture come out of that very kind of struggle?
It does when the right balance is struck.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That's important. I think Vitruvius' three principles, his three essentials, are still sound. Firmness, which means sound engineering, and commodity, which has to do with the way in which space is organized for the purposes of the people who work there, and delight, which has to do with beauty and attractiveness and so forth. Those are primary concerns of architects.
Well, I wonder what to you makes Gaudi's buildings in Spain, which are weird and undulating, in Barcelona, you love them and you describe them as beautiful. And what makes, and yet you find Frank Gehry's forms absurd. That sounds like it's just a matter of personal taste, practically.
No, I don't think it is at all. First of all, they're beautiful. There's nothing beautiful about the Stata Center. It's a grotesque hodgepodge of various surfaces juxtaposed at different angles
from one another. But surely you don't... there are those who would find Gaudi ugly and hideous and absurd, and just as there are those who find Gehry buildings beautiful as well.
I just don't think that's the case. How many people do you know that have found Gaudi's work absurd? It functions. It carries out the function for which it's designed. And on the Sagrada Familia, he would have been outraged for somebody to say that cathedral was absurd. This would have been heresy as far as he was concerned.
To the point of functionality and coming in on budget, it's not done yet, that cathedral.
Well, that's true of almost every cathedral that's ever been built.
It seems to me that architects are architects, and some of them make good buildings and some of them make bad buildings, but they are arrogant artists.
I think that I've laughed at these people about as much as I've been angry. Uh-huh. There's no question about the talent of a person like Gehry or a person like Liebeskind. But when Liebeskind comes out with a tower for the New York 9/11 Devastation Center, and he makes it 1,776 feet tall, you know, just my reaction to cornball goes
off. I'm with you on that.
Cut it out.
John Silber, I want to thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank you. I think it's been delightful to talk to you.
John Silber is the author of Architecture of the Absurd. Is there some building, new or not, that you find especially absurd? If so, you can post a photo of it on our website and we may talk about it on the show. Submit your pics to studio360.org. Coming up, a guy with no rhythm decides if he can't play music, he'll paint it.
Things like Scarlatti or Lenny Tristano or something, they touch you in a way, or in fact, maybe more than touch you, dig into you in such a way that you want to be like that in some way or get to that level. It's a very high goal.
The painter Frank Stella is up next. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
This podcast of Studio 360 is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 85,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris by David McCullough. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/studio360. That's audiblepodcast.com/studio360.
I'm Kurt Anderson. This is Studio 360. The artist Frank Stella has had a long and fabulous career. He made his name in the 1950s with a series of all-black paintings, back when that kind of thing was audacious. More recently, he's used aluminum to make these super colorful, twisty, sci-fi-looking sculptures. This summer, the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C. is showing some of those works, Stella's K-Series. They take their name from music. Domenico Scarlatti's keyboard sonatas, each of which has a K number attached to it. Turns out Frank Stella has had a love-hate relationship with music his entire career. Although WNYC's Sarah Fischko thinks it might be better described as a hate-love relationship.
Frank Stella, now 75, was born in the mid-1930s to a saxophone-playing mother and what he describes as a dance hall dandy of a father. That meant music was in the household when he was growing up.
And I had to take piano lessons, and it was really pretty much of a disaster.
It wasn't just your average piano lesson disaster. This was big. There was that thing ticking on the piano, the metronome, marking time relentlessly.
the metronome was a monster, and I had no sense of rhythm. I wanted to play this piece, which was boogie-woogie. You know, I could do the notes, but I couldn't get the rhythm. I mean, it was just impossible for me to do it. And when I realized that there was no way that that was ever going to happen, I kind of just let it go.
Music continued to be a major force, a major negative force in Stella's life when he went away to school in Massachusetts.
It was really brutal. We had to listen to music, and it was basically what you would call a music appreciation course. And, you know, you were supposed to be able to tell the oboe from the flute and when the strings came in. And I mean, for me, it was a kind of nightmare. The killer was Smetana's Moldau. I mean, after that, I probably never wanted to listen to music.
But as often happens, Frank Stella got hooked on the very thing that put him off. The piano lessons receded in his memory. The negative vibes turned positive, and music started to become a big part of his life and work, especially when he came to New York to paint.
I used to walk across Canal Street and go to the Blue Note. You know, I was just bowled over, as they say, by Lenny Tristano. I can still see him above the bar with his moccasins and white athletic socks pushing on the pedals and playing away.
Stella became so attached to certain pieces of music, he started to name his paintings after them. He did one called Line Up after the Tristano tune with that name. And Stella did another one called Turkish Mambo, named after Tristano's piece with different rhythms recorded one over the other, requiring an almost metronomic precision. The jazz clubs became gathering places, too, in that era.
It was a very big scene at the Five Spot with Monk. I mean, people like Jasper and Bob Rauschenberg, and then a lot of the second-generation abstract expressionists that were there. I mean, you know, people went all the time. It was a place to go. But I remember that I was taken with Johnny Griffin, the sax player. He seemed to me to be in another world. And Thelonious, I mean, was great in his way, too, but there was something about the combination.
The connection between the abstract painters and the jazz scene is well known, but Stella went to somewhat unexpected places as well. He was drawn to older sounds, like Hyena Stomp, for example, a painting he named after the Jelly Roll Morton recording from the mid-1920s. And he was attracted to even older sounds than that.
I was very taken with Rameau.
He liked various suites and operas by that 18th century French composer and thinker. He was especially taken with Rameau's Les Indes Galantes, an opera ballet that told stories about love and adventure in the New World and the Near East.
And I made a lot of paintings about that.
But lately he's been drawn to Domenico Scarlatti, the Italian composer who went to Spain late in his life and had an epiphany. Scarlatti discovered Spanish guitar music and spent the rest of his musical life writing 555 sonatas for keyboard, trying to capture in them the rhythms and sonorities he heard by way of Spanish guitar. Stella, working late in his life, found Scarlatti irresistible, not to mention inexhaustible.
One of the nice things about it is there's 500 numbers, so I'm not going to run out.
Stella's new set of works is known as the K series. The K is for Ralph Kirkpatrick, the scholar and harpsichordist who became obsessed with the obsessive Scarlatti. Kirkpatrick cataloged Scarlatti's sonatas and assigned a K number to each piece. Stella, in turn, got just a little obsessed with Scarlatti and Kirkpatrick, and so far has made 8 pieces of three-dimensional art in his K series, which he began in 2006. The works are multicolored, polychrome, wall-mounted structures with loops and spirals. Which is not to say Stella's work was inspired by music. He doesn't much like that word.
Mainly it's a process of working on something and being involved in it. I think that it's true, though, with things like Scarlatti or Lenny Tristano or something. They touch you in a way, or in fact, maybe more than touch you, dig into you in such a way that you want to be like that in some way or get to that level. It's a very high goal.
As for the infernal metronome, that still haunts the artist.
Yes, I can still see it. And the pyramidal form, I mean, it was kind of impenetrable. Yeah, it's an impenetrable fortress. And, you know, I often wonder, you know, people see rhythm in my paintings and everything, and I have no idea about what they mean or what it is. I can't keep up with the metronome. I can't move my feet. I can't dance.
Or let's just say his dancing has taken another form. Frank Stella has overcome the metronome and put the music, the rhythm, and the dancing on view, with no music making or feet shuffling necessary, and no ticking. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fishko.
You can see some pictures of Frank Stella's K-Works at studio360.org, or if you're in Washington, D.C., at the Phillips Collection. Earlier this month, we lost one of the great American artists, the painter Cy Twombly, who was 83. Twombly defied categories. He was a generation younger than the abstract expressionists like Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning, and his work looked much more lighthearted. It often resembled naughty, exuberant, childlike scribbles, and a lot of the time, he baffled the critic. But his work turned out to be hugely influential for younger artists.
Listen, baby, I won't leave no trace. I'll lie out here for some cleaner.
The singer-songwriter Tiff Merritt encountered Twombly by accident one day, taking a break from the life of a touring musician.
I had been on tour for almost a year in a van with a bunch of boys, which is sometimes lovely and sometimes really hard. And I thought, gosh, I don't really know what comes next, but I'm really tired. And maybe I should take myself on a vacation. And then I thought, maybe I should take myself on a vacation to Paris. And then I thought, maybe I should rent a flat with a piano in Paris. And I actually Googled Paris apartment and piano, thinking, of course, that nothing would come up. I mean, thinking I would have a laugh. But I actually found an apartment with a piano in it, and off I went. When I got to Paris, some magic things started to happen, and I started to write within a few days of getting there. Lost out. And so I called home and I said, you know what? I'm not coming home for a while. And I made that same phone call about 7 times.
Falling this like brand new rain. Places I have never been.
When I would get kind of burnt out from writing, I would take pictures or look at art or look at sculpture or go to a museum. And I had been wanting to go to the Centre Pompidou because there's this amazing view of the city of Paris. And I sometimes hesitate to go to these big collections of artwork of modern, where it's a lot of artists, because I get lost. So I was just sort of walking through the museum in a really loose way, taking it in, and I came around a corner, and there was this enormous canvas, and it just stopped me dead in my tracks, and it made me cry, and I couldn't walk away from it. I could not walk away from it. And it was a Cy Twombly painting, Achilles Mourning the Death of Patroclus. It's an enormous, enormous canvas, and it's really, really simple white canvas with a few pencil scratchings and these tightly drawn red balls, almost as if a child or a very angry person made circles or scribbles on a page, and this was an expression of the interior life of these people. It was passionate, it was sensual, it was vital, it was angry, and it was distilled with such intensity into these few lines. And as a songwriter, I'm trying to distill all of that in a few lines too.
A feeling has me and tells me it will never stay.
I guess somebody could think it was just scribbles, but isn't that what we all are? We're just scribbles.
Run away. Close gets so far away.
To see something so true and so strong, you go home with a renewed sense of purpose, and you say, that's what I was trying to do.
La nuit s'est pris, s'embrasse.
I wrote one song in French on the record called Mille Tendresses, and that song talks about how anything of importance in the world happens in these very small and tender moments, and that's where I want to live, that's where I want to go, that's where I find you. And I thought that song tugged at the intimacy of this painting.
Just a moment, tout à coup le feu, ce que je chante. Ce qui passe, c'est dans tous ces mille tendresses. Si mon corps causé, je l'ai sauvegardé. Je me suis caché.
The songwriter Tift Merritt talking about a Cy Twombly painting called Achilles Mourning the Death of Patroclus. You can see that painting at studio360.org and listen to the song that it inspired Merritt to write. Studio 360's Lita Malad produced our story. And that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen to our next one. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Michael Guerriero,
Sean Twigg,
Rachel Greenberg, Liz Viella.
Special thanks this week to WNYC's Wayne Schulmeister and Paul Schneider, and, as ever, Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Miranda July tells your future.
I don't know what your dilemma is, so I would like you to send it to me now, psychically.
She's an artist, a filmmaker, and a fiction writer. And now she's a psychic.
Is there a person involved in this? Ah, I knew it.
Miranda July predicts the future next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.